Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and all right, so we have this week and next week that on love your neighbor as yourself. In the bulletin it says we're talking about loving our enemies, but I want to take a different tack this morning. As I reflected on the things that my friend Mike and Jerry shared last week and the direction that we've taken over the last 6 years to try to say, we want to be a missional church. So I want to reflect on that this morning. And I want to reflect on it in the concept of engaging our neighbors. And what I really want to do, but I'm not going to do, is I would like to ask all of the people on this side of the room to get up and walk over to that side of the room. And all of the people here get up and walk to this side of the room here. So if any of you want to do that, go ahead and do that. If not, just stay where you are and we'll just imagine that it's taking place. Oh, good. Thank you. Many are called, but few are chosen. Good. So what you've just done, some people have just walked across the room. And that's the image I want to use. I want to use this image of engaging the world is all about walking across the room. It's making a choice to move out of one place into another place in order to demonstrate the love of God in tangible ways. Our God is ascending God. The Father sends the Son into the world to be one of us and to redeem the world. He engages rather than disengages. God has a mission, and therefore we, his people, have a mission. I'm going to talk more about that next week, but we're talking about today in terms of engaging the world by walking across the room, walking across the road, doing what Doug prayed about this morning in terms of building bridges. The walls fall down and we build bridges. We find our unity in Christ within the church, and then as Christ's representatives, we go into the world. We walk across the room. Since God is a God of engagement, I would suggest that we, his people, are called to be people of engagement. God engages. His mission is defined by the life, death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus. So one of the things I've been saying over the last 4 weeks is that Jesus is our mediator. He's the one that is the big bridge builder between God and humanity. But not only that, in his bridge building, he creates unity across all the lines that separate people. So just meditate on that reality in the book of Ephesians and the book of Philippians and how God does that through Jesus. So he's our mediator. What we sang about this morning is he's our master. He's the Lord. He's not only the Lord of the church, he's the Lord of the world. Oftentimes we begin to think that he's going to be Lord of the world when he returns. But the truth is he is Lord now. That's what the ascension is all about. He ascends to be with the Father and sits at the right hand where he reigns. Now. Present. So how does that reign get worked out? It gets worked out through us, his people. Well, how do we do that? He's not only our mediator, he's our master, so we listen to him, and he's our model. We follow his way. We do things his way. When the average Jew would go out of their way to make sure that they didn't have any contact with Samaritans, Jesus makes an intentional decision to walk into the heart of Samaria. When the average Jew, male Jew, would have nothing to do with women, Jesus makes an intentional decision to sit down with a Samaritan woman at the well and engage her in conversation. And it turns out to be an incredibly life-giving conversation. His disciples are not there because they've been sent to go into the city to get food. So they go get food and they have as little contact as possible with the Samaritans. Jesus has the conversation with the woman And she goes back into the city and she comes out and she brings new disciples with her in that short period of time. Because not only has she been engaged by the Lord of life, but then she goes and engages in the name of the one who is the Lord of life. When the average person that in Jesus' day would stay clear of lepers, Jesus makes a point of engaging and actually touching and brings healing. When others abhorred and stayed away from Roman soldiers, the occupying army, Jesus actually engages, brings healing, and actually brings one of those soldiers and uses them as an example of faith, greater faith than any faith exhibited within the people of God. When the Pharisees avoided immoral women and sought to condemn them, said that we don't want to have anything to do with them, we have boundaries, we're just not going to go there, Jesus actually invites immoral women into his circle of relationships and brings healing, calls them to a new life, calls them to a new community, transforming. He walks across the room, across the road, and engages. And he does it in a redemptive way. For the average religious person of the day, Jesus spent most of his time with all the wrong people in the wrong places. He was called a drunken winebibber. He was accused of being with sinners, including them in his circle of relationships. Basically, the Pharisees looked at Jesus and say, "You're just wrong. You're wrong. They knew what was right. You're wrong." But God says to us through Jesus and his word that Jesus was right. He demonstrated at every level of his life God's mission. He reached out to the lost, the least, the left behind, the left out, and he brought them in. Now, I would suggest to you that that is the mission of the church. We tend to look at the church and its organizing principle as this event on Sunday morning. And I would suggest that we need to flip that on its head and say this is one of the things that we are called to, but our organizing principle needs to be the mission of the church. Our mission is the announcement and demonstration of the Lordship of Jesus Christ. If we are wrapped up in his word and his mission, we will, in fact, worship God furiously. How many of you can say that you worship God furiously? We will love one another deeply, and we don't always love one another deeply. We often do. One of the things this church does well is love one another. We will also make disciples as if our life depended upon it. But we don't often do that. In fact, that's one of the areas that we need as a church to get better at. And we also need to engage the world promiscuously. And we'll do that if we're caught up, wrapped up, immersed, wholly given to the mission of God and the mission of the church. We will, in fact, walk across the room. So I want to share with you this morning some stories of people in our church and give examples of what it means to look like to engage the world, to walk across the room, to walk across the road. And the first one is Larry Klaus. So if Larry would come on forward, and I have a DVD that Larry has done, and I'd like him to talk about it and watch the DVD and then talk about afterwards why he does it. So.
One of my jobs is a photojournalist, and for the last couple of years, I've been working on a documentary project that's called Insight Hope, and it's about the athletes of the Wounded Warrior Project. And before you see the images, I just want to say a quick word about the music that you'll also hear, Steve Skiba's music. It's the most powerful piece of music I have ever heard in my life. He played it a couple of years ago here right before Palm Sunday. When Steve talks about this piece of music, he talks about four movements. When I hear it, though, there are six. And these pictures are grouped according to the six movements that I see. So I hope the sound guys can play the music just at the top of the volume. So here we go.
Great. Thank you.
still in the fight. The latest statistic I've heard is that there are more soldiers that have died from suicide after they've gotten back home than have been killed in combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. Down the side of these guys' uniforms, still in fight, you saw a Marine Corps coach, the cyclist's face in his hands, who had just finished one of the cycling races. And the coach had his face in his hands going, "I knew you could do it. I knew you could do it." And the cyclist was saying, "I did it for you, coach. I did it for you." What motivates me for this is different things at different times. What motivates me at the moment is a picture you didn't see in there, but it's a picture of an Air Force cyclist. His name is Jim Castanatis. He has an upper body injury, so he races a recumbent bicycle. And the recumbent cyclist raced for 30 kilometers, three laps around a 10K loop. And when he came around this past May, on the bell lap, he had a flat tire. And they don't have mechanics. They don't have team cars that jump in with mechanics that jump out and change their tires. And so he came through with a flat tire, and the race officials saw it, the race announcer saw it, and they called him off. They called his number, they called his name, and they said, "Your race is good. You're done. Great race." He didn't look up. Didn't acknowledge that at all. He pedaled on past me. And I don't think the announcers knew that the mic was still live. And I heard one of the officials go, "Didn't he hear us? He can stop. Is he still going?" And there were some Navy guys standing behind me. And I heard one of them say, "What did he think he was going to do?" And he rode on. And then his Navy teammates went and found him. And they ran the loop with him. And when he came across the finish line, there was a whole group of Navy guys that were running with him. And when he got across, they just swarmed over him. And his coach came out, who was also a single-leg amputee. And his coach straddled him and got down right over him and put his hand right on his heart. And they were nose to nose. And his coach was going, "This is who you are. This is who you are. You did not give up. You did not give up." Everybody saw this. I get to shoot a lot of famous athletes, but I have never seen anything like these guys. And so I show up and I tell their story. Thanks,
Lord. I've asked Don Shive to share one little story of his life, of how he walks across the room.
8.5 years ago, I was sitting in my favorite coffee shop, which at the time was called Purple Mountain. It's now called Common Grounds. Across the parking lot from Gold's Gym, where I try to work out.
Oh, you're right. She's taken to...
Oh, okay. I was sitting here at lunchtime, enjoying a cup of coffee, when this punk kid walks in. He was an escapee from Rampart High School down the way here. The penitentiary, as he called it. He bought himself a chai frappe. And our eyes met, and I said, "That's not much of a lunch." And he came on over and sat down next to me. That started a strong relationship that continues to today. Now, the interesting thing about this is he is everything I am not. I thought he was 17 or 18 because he was very articulate, knowledgeable, friendly, engaging. In fact, later I was told by his mother, "Be careful, he can talk the feathers off a chicken." And he really tried to do that. He ended up being 15. Blew me out of the water. He came back the next day, and the next day, and the next day, escaping from Rampart, he was not allowed to leave. I started to take him back, and I was willing to drop him off right at the front door. And he said, no, drop me off at the corner up here, Lexington and Union, because he wanted to get some fresh air, which is still to this day a euphemism for I need a cigarette. Well, this young man, being young, and I'm old, was an atheist. I'm Christian. An evolutionist, a scientist, and I like creationism. He was a pothead, and I always pictured a guy with a pot on his head. That's how naive I was. I used him, though, as a counselor for a resource. I know more about marijuana than I really need to know, but it was very helpful because he gave me all that information. He hated his family. I love my family. Everything I am, he isn't. And still to this day, he's now 23, soon to be 24. We began a relationship. I used to call him my young friend, and he called me friend. I have spent a lot of time with him. I've been called in the middle of the night by his mother to help her go down to CJC, the jail, to bail him out when he got in trouble with the law. He would come and complain about, school is so boring, I hate this. He would tell me how he was going to lie to his mother, that she wouldn't find out that he was escaping as he was. And I just began sharing myself with him, not in a way that was obtrusive. Every once in a while, I would get on spiritual things, and he would go, don't even go there. Well, I learned to not go there in that fashion. He was unemployed. I've seen him go through being a car salesman, being a jewelry salesman. Presently, he is employed as a bank teller and seems to be doing well right now. He has gone through, I've lost track of the bachelorettes that he has gone through in relationships. I haven't even kept track of that. He's a womanizer. So what's a guy like me doing with a young man like that? I don't know. I consider this a God thing. In fact, one day, Men to Men was talking about having something on friendship. So I invited my friend to come with me to Men to Men to speak from his perspective about our relationship. And lo and behold, he came. And it was very interesting that he would do that. The one thing he keeps saying that is kind of unusual for me, he would say, Don, do you know why I like you? I'd say, why is that? Because you don't judge me. And I come from a background, a spiritual background of judgment. Judgmentalism, I call it. And I've learned over time that that's not my role to do that. And as much as my heart wants him to come, I used to say I want to love him to death, but I've learned to say I want to love him to life. And that sense of urgency and responsibility on my part to do something to get him to come to the Lord, Bill helped me a long time ago saying, hey, forget about it, Don. That's not your responsibility. That's the Spirit's responsibility to bring him. So at this point, this relationship continues. He did make it through college, UCCS, and graduated with a degree in international business, for which he says, I have no idea how I'm going to use it. I have no purpose in life. I don't know where I'm going. And lo and behold, a couple months ago, he called and said, hey, Don, I'm going back to school. So I'm thinking, cool, you're going on for your master's. And he says, no, I'm going to work on another bachelor's. I can't do anything with my international business degree. I'm going to get an engineering degree in mechanical engineering. So I don't know what this fellow is doing or where he's going, but our friendship is like that. I consider him a real jewel. In our friendship, he has taught me to write poetry, which is something, a gift I've learned from him. But one of the things that keeps me going, and our church had in the bulletin a long time ago this phrase that I really think is cool, and that ties in to what we're talking about. The holiest moment of the church service is the moment when God's people, strengthened by preaching and sacrament, go out of the church door into the world to be the church. And that's one of my goals in this relationship with this friend of mine, to be the church in his life.
Thanks, Don. I've asked Dave Little if he would share as well. You can stay right there. And then, Dave, when you're done, could you give the microphone to Doug Moore?
All right.
And he'll share.
Is this thing? There we go. Bill has asked me to share a couple things that I crossed the room. One of them is, in the last few weeks, I have begun training with the Church's Shalom group. And folks, if you want to join a group that's dedicated, believers, faithful in the power of healing prayer, I encourage you to check out that group and join them. They are just wonderful people. Secondly, in the past year, about a year ago, I talked to my spiritual advisor, Pastor Bill Tiber, and said, Bill, I think I'd like to begin doing some things with the hospital. So about, I went through a whole bunch of interviews and things, and I have joined the chaplain group at Penrose Hospital. I'm in training right at the moment to become a spiritual visitation person for people who are patients and for their families. It is far more training than I had expected, but wonderful training. To be a volunteer, it's amazing the things you have to go through at the hospital to become a volunteer. And by the way, they have 700 volunteers at Penrose Hospital. So at any rate, I've started the training, and the question was asked, why did I do it? Well, first of all, the most important thing for me is I had to get out of myself. I wanted something to try to get out of Dave Little. And so about 3 years ago, my wife died, and I spent a lot of time in the hospital, and I never felt so alone in my life, and decided that if there was any way, I was going to try to help people who were in that situation. So I've prayed about it a lot. I talked to Bill a couple of times and Kathy, and they advised me to go talk to the chaplain, and that's what I did. The one thing I have learned in the last several weeks of training is that in the surgery room and in the emergency room, it's a great equalizer. There, I don't care who you are or what your background is or what your faith is or what your race is or what your gender is, when you come into surgery room or you come into emergency, we are all equals. And if there's anything that I have learned is that it's them that's important. It is not me. If we're going to walk across the room, somehow we have to walk out of ourselves and into other people. That's what I hope to do. I've also been advised that I'm going to go through the training. And if this is not what God wants me to do, I'll know about it. But right now, I believe that's what he's asking me to do, commanding me to do, and that's what we're told to do. So that's what I'm going to try to do. That's it.
What Dave shared, one thing that he said that I think is a lesson for many of us is, don't waste your pain. The pain of his life has actually moved him into a place where he can walk across the room to bring redemptive life to somebody else. Doug, thanks.
One of my favorite stories begins with the proper and right sort of people grumbling about Jesus as he associates with exactly the wrong sort of people. Jesus proceeds to tell some parables about a lost sheep and a lost coin and finally a lost son. If you head down to the rescue mission around dinner time, you'll find a whole bunch of the wrong sort of people. They hang out there. The rescue mission opens its doors to these people. There are some lost coins. There are more lost sheep. But by and large, most of the people there are lost sons and daughters who have messed up their lives because of choices that they have made. At the rescue mission, they're invited and welcomed in with no questions asked. They are fed and clothed, and they don't have to clean up their act first. They do have to behave a little bit while they're there, but really not much. So the rescue mission reaches out to the downtrodden, the poor, the hungry, the miserable, and the disenfranchised. The very kind of people that I think Jesus hung out with a lot and engaged with. So a number of years ago, by invitation, I went down and started hanging out down there. Now my function, my excuse for being there is I take my guitar and we sing a little bit, and then mostly I read them stories out of the King's Storybook. And I might share a few words. But that's not what's important about walking across the room or across town to the rescue mission to me. What I discovered is that nearly every person down there has a story that they can't wait to tell me. And I found out, even though I didn't really know this before, but as we're going to say, I used to sing about it a lot here at church, but I found out that these people were worth talking to. These people were worth sitting down with and hearing their story. In terms of, it goes on down there, these people were worth rescuing. But it's not about me going down and trying to rescue somebody. What I got out of it is that I found my life was much richer because those people were in it. Much the same as I think Jesus was trying to communicate, that heaven is richer with those people in it, that God wants those people there. And that's the number one message that I deliver down there, is that God is for you, not against you, and that he doesn't want you on the outside, he wants you on the inside. The other thing that I get from that is a glimpse, a little taste of what it's like for heaven to be rejoicing when real people, Robert and Virgil and Jeffrey, finish the program and start living redeemed lives that were trashed and in the pit of despair. I want to read the mission statement of the rescue mission. I want you to listen for our vision statement in there about building bridges. To partner and engage the local church and community to serve the poor and homeless, feed the hungry, and minister to the addicted with the transforming message of the gospel. So why am I engaged down at the Colorado Springs Rescue Mission? Because to me that sounds so Jesus.
Victor. Running out of time, but I've got two more. Andy Fletcher and then Elizabeth Robinoff. So, Andy, keep it short.
Thanks, Bill. All done. I don't do short. I'll do short. I have a stealth ministry. I don't know that there are any more of those, because if there are, nobody talks about them. That's what the word stealth means. My stealth ministry is to the people, a number of groups, but by and large to people who believe that science has proven that God does not exist,
and that the question is settled and that there is no argument to be had. And science doesn't do that, but you have to look around to find the right science. I don't talk about evolution. I don't talk about, apologies, Don, creationism or intelligent design. I talk about physics, and there is ample evidence in physics to offer and to discover that that God does exist and that he did create the universe, but he didn't do it the way you think he did, and he didn't do it the way that anybody else thinks he did. The universe is bizarre and weird and wondrous and magical and mysterious. And so I travel all over. I went to the rescue mission a couple of times, Doug, and I was amazed at how well they did. I shouldn't have been. Should have known better, but they were brilliant. I go to Rampart. I go to Palmer. I go to Shanghai. I go to Kuala Lumpur. I go to Peru. I go to Australia. I go to wherever I can find a school that will listen to me. That's all over the place. But these are tough nuts to crack. They think they're smarter than everybody else. They think they're smarter than God. They think they've all got it all figured out. And they think that science gives them the basis on which to stand. The tragedy is that Richard Dawkins of Oxford is kind of the pope of the new atheist movement, the high priest of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the new atheist. And the way that Dawkins describes his view of the universe, which has sort of become their little anthem, is to say something like this, that the universe has precisely the properties you would expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pointless indifference. Human beings are machines for propagating DNA, and that is the hope that he offers them for living in the world. Christ offers something else altogether, and it is amazing how thrilled people are to hear that there is a very, very strong possibility that God is behind it. They are tough, and they need our prayers. They are not hungry, except for at the rescue mission. They are not starving. They are elite. They are entitled. They are coddled. They are wealthy. They are brilliant. They live all over the world. They are polyglots, and they are lost. And that's what I get to do.
Well, talk about stealth. Bill asked me a question on Friday morning, and I answered it, and he said, good. And then this morning he said, are you ready to speak? And I went, huh? So what was the question you asked me, Bill?
Elizabeth, what do you do? What is the one thing that you do in your life that is engaging the world that's not a part of Feed My Serving Children or anything big like that?
And my answer was, although no one usually accuses me of being brief, I will be brief. My answer was, I try the best I can to do the things that I think Jesus would want me to do, and therefore live out the gospel, and if necessary, I use words if I'm asked a question. That's it.
Okay, thank you. But she also works in a place called Hangers, which is
a thrift store.
And so she engages people in all over the place with that kind of life sharing. In Matthew 9, we read that Jesus went about all the cities and villages teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and curing every disease and every sickness. And when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. And then he said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, ask the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. So people who have been praying for laborers, you know, we're the answer to that prayer. To go out into the world where people are like sheep, downcast, helpless. They may look like rescue mission, or they may look like Joel. They may look like the individuals that Andy's talking about. Ultimately, Jesus didn't see just crowds. Ultimately, he saw people. And when you engage with people, it doesn't take long before you discover that people have needs. I've never met a person who didn't have some significant needs, and they may have been financial, they may have been physical, they may have been relational, they may have been psychic needs. There's all different kinds of needs that people have. Jesus saw people who had needs, people without hope, people isolated, people without help, health. And he walked across the room, he walked across the road, he walked across the divide and reached out to engage them with love. And we can do the same thing. And it doesn't have to be big. It can be little. We can serve others in small ways that make a big difference. If nothing else, through simple acts of kindness. Or merely including them in our circle of relationships. Showing them a God who is for them and not against them. A God who is deeply in love with them. A God who desires healing and wholeness for them as well as for the entire world. And this can happen if we, and Don basically said this, and I thought, did he read my notes? If we live our faith and share our lives. Did you hear that? If we live our faith and share our lives. Sometimes we get it backwards. We live our lives and we share our faith. And I would suggest that we need to get it the other way around. We need to live our faith. And then we need to share our lives. And we need to look for missional moments. Seek to be more present than and less absent. To be more aware and less distracted. To be more sensitive and less superficial. To be more interruptible, less busy. If we live that way, we will find ourselves in the midst of missional moments, opportunities to show someone that we care and, in fact, that God cares. So stay awake, love the one you're with, take the extra step. This is the reality of the kingdom of God, and here's the most important point, it's eternal. Father, I ask that you would press this message home to us. And as we give of our tithes and our offerings this morning, we would recognize that you want us to give money. You want us to give money to help this church do its ministry. You want us to give money in order for your kingdom to be established. But most importantly, you want us to give not just our money, but you want us to give of ourselves. You want us to share our lives. To give our lives to you and share our lives with others. May it be so, Lord. May it be so. Amen.